You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. Our state's healthcare systems are once again being overwhelmed by COVID-19. This time, the Omicron variant is hitting Idaho hard. In fact, according to data from the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare, we saw 3,355 positive cases of COVID just yesterday. That's a new record high for our state. And during a news briefing Tuesday, health leaders from across the state said if something doesn't shift, we will likely see crisis standards of care reactivated. If you remember, we have only been out of that for a month. Joining us today are Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System and a current member of the Idaho Coronavirus Task Force, along with Dr. Michael Bourne, Chief Medical Officer at St. Alphonsus Regional Medical Center in Boise. I want to thank both of you for joining us today.
Thanks, Gemma.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And we have a lot to get to today. So, Dr. Pate, let's just start with what we are seeing from a positivity rate standpoint with Omicron, and frankly, what that means.
Well, it's quite extraordinary. We have certainly seen our share of surges in the past with previous variants. We've seen high levels of disease transmission, high levels of testing positivity, but we're beating all records. So I think it speaks to the fact that Omicron that we're dealing with right now is far more transmissible, that lots of people are testing positive, and that, like was in the tee-up, that a lot of the spread is occurring at home and in no small part to children in schools bringing it at home to their families, where there are often people that either can't be vaccinated or have chosen not to.
And Dr. Bourne, I know at St. Alphonsus, you did have to close some urgent cares over the weekend. We know primary health closed 7 urgent cares over the weekend. Is this kind of a precursor to what we could see happening in the hospitals in the coming weeks? And what I mean by that is these urgent cares are closing down because staffing. Either staff are sick or they're isolating or they're home with someone that has Omicron.
That's exactly right. It's to confirm what Dr. Pate just shared in terms of the rapid spread of the Omicron variant and the test positivity rate. Our positivity rates at St. Alphonsus have doubled in the last 2 weeks, and I was informed that as of this morning, our positivity rate is 44.5%. Now, by comparison, our last peak back in September, we were slightly under 30%. So that's a significant rise in positivity, and it's still going up. And to your question about urgent cares and staffing, yes, workers are sick, family members are sick, and so that has a certain an impact on our ability to field healthcare staff.
Dr. Bourne, are you concerned that we could potentially go back into crisis standards of care if something, frankly, doesn't shift in the next couple of weeks?
Yes, certainly that concern is there. I mean, we assess the situation, you know, a few weeks ago we were assessing it weekly, now we're assessing it daily. Well, what we do know is that even though the hospitalizations with Omicron are not at the same rate as Delta, it's a numbers game. And so since we're seeing this still rise in the positivity rate and the lag in hospitalizations, there's a very real possibility that we could end up in that situation. That's why we need to monitor it closely and make those decisions as a health system and as a community.
Dr. Pate, what can we be learning from what we're seeing in schools, in particular certain school districts closing down? Horseshoe Bend School District has closed for the week. The Caldwell School District closed for, I believe, 2 days last week. There are 5 schools in the Nampa School District that have closed for the remainder of the week. I mean, it as a parent, it feels like I'm just waiting for a call, sitting on pins and needles for my kids' schools to shut down. I know that some of these schools as well are not mask required, so it's mask optional.
Well, you're not alone, Gemma. I would hope that the lesson that we learn is you can't have your cake and eat it too. And basically what I'm talking about is we have learned over this pandemic. We first dealt with this issue about, okay, do we control the pandemic or do we protect the economy? And that's a false dichotomy. You have to do both. You have to get the pandemic under control in order to protect the economy. And then the second is, well, according to a lot of parents, well, we want our kids physically in school 5 days a week, but we don't want them to wear masks. Well, I don't know how you do that with a highly transmissible virus that is airborne when kids are going to be in classes with a lot of other students indoors for a long time and that you have so many vulnerable people. So, you know, if you have to decide what's more important to you, is it more important that the kids are physically in school or is it more important to you that they don't wear masks? Because those two choices are incompatible, as we've seen last year, and now we're repeating the same mistakes this year. And I think the thing is that a lot of parents like you, who actually, as we saw with West Sader, are in the majority, they've got to speak up if they don't want to have their kids put in danger. They have to speak up. They have to show up to vote. They have to have their voices heard. And I understand the disadvantages because they are taking it seriously. They don't want to show up in a meeting with a large number of people where they might be at risk, but they have to make their voices heard.
And can we talk about masks? Because there were new CDC recommendations that came out this week and recommending higher level masks, N95s, KN95s. So Dr. Pate, let's start there as to why we're seeing these new recommendations. Even a surgical mask, they're saying, is better than the cloth masks that the majority of us have been wearing over the last year and a half.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, many of us have been quite surprised that it's taken the CDC this long to come out and say this. This is something that we've known for a long time. Early on, when we had less transmissible strains, it wasn't as big a deal because you do get some protection from the cloth masks. And of course, the one point is you want everybody to wear whatever they can. And if, you know, somebody doesn't have access to these higher quality masks or can't afford it, you still want them to, you don't want to tell them it's no good, so don't wear it. But what we have come to realize as Alpha got more transmissible than the variants we dealt with in 2020, and then Delta was more transmissible than Alpha, and now Omicron is more transmissible than Delta, what we have to do is we have to change as the virus changes. And part of that is that there is now much more airborne transmission. That means small droplets that are carried on airstreams. So the 6 feet of physical distancing, that's predominantly a defense against droplets, also some to aerosols. But aerosols can travel much further in a room. And if you have somebody who is infected and they have a high viral load of infectious virus, they can transmit it considerable distances. And that's why the CDC is finally coming up with this guidance. The biggest problem that we've had with cloth masks and even some surgical masks is, number one, I still see people wearing those masks under their nose. Mm-hmm. The second if you look at people's faces, oftentimes where their cheeks are, you'll see gaps. So many will remember last year that we suggested double masking, put a cloth mask over your surgical mask. And the reason for that is it tended to help close that gap. But now that we're dealing with such a transmissible virus, really what we want is form-fitting masks that fit tightly to the face, have a nose piece where you can adjust it to make sure that it is closing any gap around your nose and that it fits tightly to your cheeks and around to your chin. And those are the KN95s and N95s. Plus, they have a higher degree of filtering capability protect people that have to be in these high-risk situations.
You did mention, Dr. Pate, that, I mean, any protection is better than no protection. And I'm sure there are other parents out there that are in the same situation that I am, that my kids got used to wearing cloth masks. They were comfortable with that. In the last week, we've switched to surgical masks. I cannot get my kids to wear KN95s. I put them in their backpacks before they go to school. So with that said, I mean, I'm sitting here, you know, sending them to school, fingers crossed they'll wear those, knowing that they won't. So at least is a surgical mask, I mean, from a standpoint of just getting your kids to make sure that they're wearing their mask. Is that a good?
Absolutely. Absolutely, Gemma. Because if you send them with the KN95 or N95 and they're not going to wear it, well, then they're not going to get any benefit. So you're right. It would be far better for them to wear a surgical mask than no mask. Now, what I do encourage people to do, of course, young children are going to be the ones who least tolerate these higher quality masks. So younger children, if you can get them in a cloth mask, if you can get them in a surgical mask, do what you can do. Now, they are getting better with some of these cloth masks and even now making kids N95s and KN95s that are much more comfortable and better form-fitting. So if you see an option, even if it's cloth for a young child, but it is one that kind of draws up the mask so there's not as big a gaps, then go with that. But what you might do is look at some of the websites that are offering children's K95 and the also the N95 mask and look at those and get a small amount. And maybe you even pitch in with a group of your fellow parents and you buy one box of masks, you spread it around, you let the kids try it and see if they're comfortable for them. And then if not, then try another one and until you find one that your kids are comfortable in and will wear for a long period of time.
This listener wants to know who is paying for the medical care of coronavirus victims. Let's take a listen.
What does it cost to care for COVID? Specifically, one, what does it cost for testing locally and or nationally? And two, what does it cost to provide treatment for the illness locally and or nationally? Does the private insurance industry cover for this, or is it the federal government? And if it's the federal government, where does the funding come from? Thank you.
So, Dr. Pate, Dr. Bourne, if you could take a stab at that, I don't know who would want to start.
Well, I'm happy to, and then Dr. Bourne can certainly fill in the gaps. So it's actually a complicated question. So this is evolving. Early on, you had the federal government picking up quite a bit of the costs, and you also had some insurers granting waivers that if your illness was due to COVID, then you would have your out-of-pocket expenses waived. As we move on, that is evolving, and it's shifting more from the federal government to the private payers, but still the federal government pays for a lot. So, and to answer a question, where the funds come from for the federal government is obviously through income taxes and other revenue the government collects. So the government currently, and of course, even just today, the government has made it so that you can go online and you can order some at-home tests. The government is paying for that. If I recall correctly, there is going to be some reimbursement from payers, but I'm not totally sure about that. You also probably heard that the government is going to send out N95 masks to people's homes. The government's paying for that. But more and more, the costs are shifting to the payers. And as far as what it costs for somebody to have to be treated for COVID, and here I assume we're talking about hospitalization, that's going to be a very wide range. Obviously, if you come into the hospital, you require intensive care, you require mechanical ventilation, you require ECMO, which is a type of life support. Those things get very expensive. And so when you look at the range of hospital costs, they're typically anywhere in the neighborhood of $100,000 to perhaps $400,000, depending on how long you're in the hospital, what level of care you need. So it's very costly. I did see a recent report that said on average, the out-of-pocket expense for people is somewhere just shy of $4,000 for a hospital admission. Now, even though private insurances pay this cost, obviously, if these costs are on a trajectory where they keep growing and growing because more people are getting infected, more people are having problems, then what that does is that increases insurance rates. And so in the long run, we all pay for that. And then, of course, those persons enrolled in our Medicaid program through the state, the Medicaid program shoulders a lot of these costs. Those people that are uninsured, a lot of our nonprofit tax-exempt hospitals end up shouldering that cost. Or if people are not indigent but just chose not to have insurance, then they can be stuck with a lot of these costs. So it's a very complicated question, but I do think the point is this is a big cost and there are no free lunches. You end up paying for it in the end. I think the other thing for us to just throw in, and then I'll turn it over to Dr. Bourne if he wants to add, and that is that what we still don't know, but we're getting very concerned about, is the future healthcare costs of people that have been infected, mm-hmm. because we are discovering more and more long-term issues. Those people are going to need healthcare. That's going to raise healthcare costs. What that usually means is a lot of that cost is borne by employers. And now you're going to have employers having to make difficult decisions about, do we pass some of these costs on to our employees in what it costs them for their health insurance? And we've even seen a few employers across the country decide, instead of shifting those costs to everybody, they're going to shift them to those that are unvaccinated.
Dr. Bourne, Lee in Meridian wrote in asking that we've heard that the Omicron variant may be milder. However, we also know that you can get long-term COVID even from a mild case. So Lee wants to know, is that the same for the Omicron variant?
So I'm trying to understand the question. Can you restate it?
Even though we've heard that Omicron is a milder form of, like milder than Delta, milder than Alpha, can you still get long-term COVID?
Well, I'm not sure that we've had Omicron around long enough to really quantify that. I mean, theoretically, since we've seen long-haul COVID with previous mutations, there's certainly I don't see any reason why we wouldn't expect to see a certain percentage develop with Omicron. But back to the earlier question, and maybe this kind of ties in. I appreciated Dr. Pate's comments on the costs of COVID. And it's a great question because I think both as individuals and as a society, it's important for us to think about those costs. And at the macro level, yes, those costs are going to be borne through insurance premiums and from the government from income tax. At the more micro level, I'm not aware of the specific dollars around tests or hospitalizations. What we do see with Omicron is that hospitalizations tend to be shorter, and fortunately fewer of them require ICU care. But yet it becomes a numbers game, because if we just have sheer greater numbers of people who require hospitalization, that continues to add cost. In terms of the indirect costs, I mean, there's impacts on the economy in terms of its impact on businesses, the long-term effects of COVID. And the other component to that would be, and we'll wait and see how this plays out over time, if there are populations who are having delayed care, whether that's for joint replacement or cancer care or cancer screenings as a result of this, that too is going to cause a wave of downstream costs to us as a society.
Mm. Dr. Pate, Ann wrote in saying, I've been hearing that home tests are much more likely to give false negatives for Omicron. Is there evidence to support that?
There is, and it's really just a matter of timing. So it's not that the home test, and she says home test, there's different kinds of home tests, but usually when people say home tests, what they're referring to is the rapid antigen tests. So assuming that's what we're talking about, it's not that they don't work. It's just that with Omicron, what we have seen is that to get to a high enough viral load where we can get a positive test, it takes a few days. And whereas with previous variants, most often, like with Delta, very often, as soon as somebody had symptoms, they were also positive on these rapid antigen tests. What we now see is that it's often a day or two after getting symptoms that people test positive. So here's the important point to your question. Number one, if you have a family member who has symptoms and doesn't feel well, and you test them immediately, which I'm going to recommend you not, but if you do test them immediately and it's negative, that does not mean they do not have COVID. So again, like with all illnesses, if somebody's not feeling well, if they're sick, stay home. And then what I would recommend now that we're in Omicron is if that family member has symptoms, keep them home, test them the next day, and then repeat it the following day or that day after. So by that time, you're going to have a positive test most likely.
The other thing which I would add to that is that, you know, certainly there's a proliferation of home tests being available and sold, and there's going to be variation in quality or accuracy of those tests. And I think it's very worthwhile to check to see whether the tests that you're acquiring are FDA approved, and probably stick to pharmacy chains or large national store chains in terms of where you're purchasing them, because they're again, there's going to be a proliferation of tests which are not as accurate as others.
And Dr. Bourne, tagging on that, I would assume then the COVID tests that are now available through the federal government, these home tests, and every household can get four of them for free, though I don't know what type, what brand, but I'm assuming those tests would be good tests to use once you get them in hand.
I would certainly assume that, yeah, that they're being distributed, those being distributed that way are going to be FDA approved.
Okay. Dr. Pate, JC is a parent in Nampa, and she wrote in, many, even most of Idaho schools do not have mask mandates. So besides masks, what can we do? She says one or two mitigation strategies. What do you believe those strategies are that would be the most beneficial to implement to prevent schools from having to go online due to staffing issues?
You know, in my view, what works the best is you combine mitigation measures. You don't just rely on one. Of course, if I had to rely on one, it would be masking. Now, her question is, well, what two other things in addition to masking, if you could only do, let's say, three things, what would you do? Number one, masking. Number two, I would focus on the ventilation system and air handling, air filtration systems in the schools. When I was doing school inspections for COVID, that's one of the things we focused on, looking at what was the number of air exchanges per hour in which types of rooms, particularly the ones that were posing highest risk, like cafeterias, music rooms, those kind of things. So I would focus on ventilation, air handling, and air filtration as my second. And then if I had a third, I would implement a testing strategy.
Mm. Dr. Bourne, a listener wrote in wanting to ask, can you please address the amount of protection face shields provide?
Well, face shields, in addition to creating the barrier over the nose and mouth, are going to also create some protection of the eyes. I can't, I don't know how to quantify it in a numerical sense, but again, in some of our discussions earlier in this program around masking, with the airborne transmission of a virus, any sort of barrier is going to not prevent, but reduce the risk of the spread of that airborne virus. And so in the same way that when we talk about the effectiveness of masks as a barrier to spread of the virus, it's both a function of the material of the mask, as well as the proper fitting and compliance with wearing that barrier.
And is that, so is a face shield, I'm assuming if someone cannot wear a mask, probably better than anything, yet it's not necessarily form fitting to your nose and your mouth, Dr. Bourne.
Oh, yeah, a face shield alone, I would not think provides a significant protection at all. I mean, I'm
okay.
Not saying it,
and that's
it,
what
it's
this...
better. It's better than nothing, but it's certainly a face shield alone, I would not consider to be a replacement of a mask, again, because of the way it fits. There's all sorts of, there's not a tight fit to the face, and there's plenty of room for airborne particles to escape and be in close proximity to the individual who's wearing it.
Okay. We have another listener who called in. It's a Boise business owner, and they sent us this question.
I'm a local employer, and when I interview candidates, I've had two or three of them tell me that their physician has advised them not to get the vaccine and they're not vaccinated. Was wondering what possible reason a physician would have for doing that. And all of them are young, none of them overweight or any other red flag. So wondering if this is just an excuse to not get vaccinated, or if there is actually some legitimate health reasons for not getting vaccinated at this point. Thank you.
Dr. Pate, could you answer that question for the business owner?
Yeah, you know, there are extremely limited situations where we would say somebody can't be vaccinated, especially given that we have a choice of two completely different types of vaccines in the United States, and I suspect in the future we'll have more. And even those people with severe allergies, we have some ways that we can still get them vaccinated. So, it could be that this doctor is, you know, maybe they reported to this doctor that they had just been recently infected. Maybe he's saying, well, you don't have to get vaccinated right now, but we should vaccinate later. I mean, I'm trying to give the doctor the benefit of the doubt. On the other hand, I think it's a great point of consternation and disappointment among the medical community that there are a handful of individuals who are touting their medical credentials to promote ideologies or politics rather than science. And, I think that we know who those people are, and a lot of people know who those people are. And some of these young people may be trying to go to the same doctor so that that doctor will tell them both that they don't need to be vaccinated. Of course, that doctor's not doing them a favor. Those people are going to be at risk in the future. I personally have dealt with the situation of a rather young single woman on several occasions, single woman who got very, very sick to the point that we're having to try to figure out who is going to take care of these children if she goes into the hospital or dies. And so I think young people should not be dismissive of this. And frankly, if your doctor's telling you that you shouldn't get vaccinated unless you've really got some really crazy medical history, I'd be looking for a new doctor.
Dr. Born, Sherry? Go ahead, please do.
I just want to add to that. I mean, I can't speak for those physicians in the community. What the evidence shows is that the vaccinations which are available are safe and effective, and they provide significant protection from severe disease and death. The only medical reason that I'm aware of to not get a vaccination is if you are anaphylactic to one of the components of the vaccine, and that is an extremely, extremely unlikely and rare situation. So again, the vaccinations are safe and effective. They prevent severe disease and death.
Dr. Born, Sherry wrote in, and she says, if I get exposed to the virus, she does say I'm fully vaccinated and boosted, do we know how long it will take for me to show symptoms? And how long will it take for me to be contagious to other people?
You know, something which I read this morning is that with Omicron, the incubation period appears to be shorter than it was with prior viruses. And the number that I saw in this article is around 3 days. Now, one of the other things which contributes to the high transmissibility of COVID is that people can be transmitting it even when they're in the incubation phase before they have even developed symptoms. Which contributes to why you're wearing the mask and taking these social distancing measures is incredibly important for all of us, whether we're symptomatic or not, by that virtue, but by that the fact that when we do acquire the virus, we can be spreading it for the several days when we're incubating and not even symptomatic.
So then, Dr. Born, if someone does start to show symptoms, so let's say, you know, they get exposed, there's those 3 days where they could be contagious, they start showing symptoms maybe on day three. How long then are they contagious once they show symptoms? Do we know?
I think we have rough ranges of days, but it's like a bell curve. There might be, in terms of absolute days, how long they're contagious. We don't, and perhaps Dr. Pate has more knowledge of those day ranges.
Go ahead. Sorry, Dr. Born.
I believe that the current CDC recommendations are that if you are positive, and then you're rapidly improving, or your symptoms have resolved, 5 days is a reasonable time, but you should still take extreme precautions and use either an N95 mask and make sure that it's tight fitting. But again, that's...
And I think that...
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, and I think that that's part of... I think with these new CDC guidelines that came out in the last few weeks, it's been confusing on how many days and all of that, because, you know, for the longest time it was 10 days and now we have all of this other information coming at us. So yeah, Dr. Pate, I mean, I think what Sherry's trying to get to probably is how long does she need to be home if she gets exposed and has symptoms?
Yeah, well, I think Dr. Bourne's exactly right. You know, it's different in everybody, and it's very hard for us to test somebody to say you're contagious or you're not, because a PCR test, you know, that we send off to the labs, that's not going to tell you. We thought maybe the antigen test would tell us that if, you know, if you waited your 5 days that Dr. Bourne spoke of in isolation, and then you got the antigen test, if it's positive, then assume that you're contagious. But even recent studies have been showing very poor correlation between the amount of detectable genetic material or virus material and what your infectious viral load is. So there was so the CDC says, and I think they're right, that most of your transmission of the virus is going to occur in the first few days after you become symptomatic, the first couple before and the first three after. And I think that's true, probably on the order of 85%. But there was a helpful study out of Taiwan, and they declined to take the CDC's advice because they looked at people that came into their country, and they do far better surveillance than we do, and they tested them almost every single day. And what they found in their assessment was people were infectious out to a peak of 6 days. But again, this is a very difficult question to answer. And one important distinction is that if you are vaccinated, it's far shorter than if you're not.
And Dr. Bourne, Denise wrote in asking, do we know how transmissible the Omicron variant is outside?
Again, it's going based on the way airborne viruses are transmitted, it's going to be less transmissible outside, but it still comes down to proximity and social distancing. In the same way that when we talk about air filtration and air ventilation, if you're outside, I would still recommend maintaining the distance. If you're on tight sidewalks and pads, wearing masks, I think it's one more barrier. So it's going to be less transmissible outside than inside, but I wouldn't say that the outdoors is a safe environment, and we should change our situation awareness and using the social distancing concepts that we've learned so much about over the last few years.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Payne, Kim wrote in and she says, despite her family doing everything right, like getting vaccinated and boosted, they did all come down with a very mild case of COVID a couple of weeks ago. They've since recovered. So her question is, are we safe to go back to church in person? Is there any reason that we should continue to be ultra cautious? She goes on to say, how protected do you think we are at this point, and how long can we expect that protection to last?
Yeah, you know, it's a great question. Previously, people that did get infected with various variants, we did tend to see protection lasting for a number of months. And it too is variable. Some people develop a stronger response than others, but we could certainly oftentimes say their chances of getting infected in the next 3 months were extremely low, and then slightly increasing, thereafter. The problem with Omicron is, Omicron has very different characteristics than what we've dealt with before. It has this immune escape that we've talked about. And frankly, we don't know how robust the immune response is going to be to it. There, at first, I think many of us thought there was a very good chance, because of its difference, that we actually, those people that got infected might have more robust immunity than what we saw with previous variants. But most likely, I'm concerned that we're starting to get reports of people that have gotten reinfected with Omicron. In other words, had Omicron at the beginning, recovered, and then got Omicron again. And of course, that's very concerning. It tended to be in people that had a very mild illness the first time. And that is how it happens for a lot of viruses, that the more severe your illness, a lot of times the more immune response you have. So I think we just don't know. I don't know that I would say they have to be ultra conservative. I'm not sure what she means by what I would think of is that you got to stay home, in seclusion. I don't think you have to do that. But I think with this level of spread, I would sure still be wearing my mask when I was out with a lot of other people, because you just don't know.
We have 2 minutes left, and I would like both of you to answer this question. And Dr. Born, I'll start with you. Best piece of advice right now as we move through this next surge? I ask that because I think a lot of people are on edge and anxious right now, more so than we have been.
Well, the best piece of advice that I, two things. One, we need to not lose hope. This has been a long haul, and we just need to remain disciplined to doing the things which the evidence shows decreases risk. There's science is not black and white. It's kind of muddy when it's going on in real time, but we know that masking, social distancing, vaccines work. And so we should as we talk to our family members and neighbors, and as we engage in activities in the community, be good examples by following the guidelines, which have been shown to be effective. So remaining disciplined and remaining hopeful.
Well, and we have run out of time, but I appreciate both of you so very much for your guidance, for your answers to so many of our questions. Continue to give those questions to us, idahomatters@boisestate.edu. We will get them in as much as we possibly can. Our medical experts will be back next week. A thank you to Dr. David Pate, as well as Dr. Michael Born. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you back here tomorrow.